Into WPVMLP, Asheville, North Carolina, 103.7, streaming online, WPVMFM.org, the voice of Asheville, heard all over the world.
This is WPVM 103.7 FM in Asheville, North Carolina. Hello and welcome to A Better World on WPVM. My name is McNair Ezard and I'm your host for today's show. And our guest today is Acharya Mangalananda. He is a follower of the Indian saint Anandamayi. And he began his spiritual life in 1972 under the guidance of Swami Satchidananda, a direct disciple of Swami Sivananda, and after an inner experience with Anandamayi Ma, who was mentioned in Yogananda's autobiography of a yogi, by the way, he went to India to find her, and he traveled with her in India during 1973 and 1974. He has since been living within her lineage with some of her great disciples in ashrams in the U.S. and India, and he is the author of the book A Goddess Among Us, which is a book about Anandamayi Ma. Acharya Mangalananda, welcome to A Better World.
Thank you. It's a real joy to be here.
I appreciate you coming on. I've been looking forward to having you on the show. Why don't we get started by just having you talk to us about who was Anandamayi Ma?
Anandamayi Ma was a very unique spiritual phenomena. She had no guru externally. She had no lineage, which is very important in the Indian tradition. They always say, who's your guru? What's your lineage? She was virtually illiterate. She went to 2 years of school. She was a Bengali married woman. Later, she became a widow when her husband passed away. But from birth, she was in a state of perfect unitive divine consciousness. She literally opened her eyes and she was a realized being. We have many different ideas of who and what Ma is and was. But let's just say she was a great manifestation of spiritual consciousness and energy. And she never promoted herself. She never, she was very strict about not allowing even posters and things. She would just move quietly through the world. And like a bee to honey, devotees were attracted to her in a very natural and spontaneous way. And she became, after just a few years of her adult life, very widely recognized as a great spiritual luminary by everyone in India. I mean, really, truly, she's universally respected. At first, the sadhus, the sannyasis, and the established lineages of monks and nuns didn't recognize her because, like I say, she had no lineage she came from. But then one sadhu invited all the heads of the different akaras, that's the monastic orders, to a big meeting. It was kind of a surprise. And he loved Ma, and he had Ma there just for the whole weekend, just to sit with him and talk. And at first, they were very skeptical about this Bengali lady. But then by the end of the time, they were all just like total Ma devotees. And from that time, she was so respected that even in the Kumbh Mela, which is every 12 years, there's a Kumbh Mela, the largest gathering on earth, and all the sadhus come. There's literally something like 10 million people there. And the sadhus would always insist that Ma lead the whole procession in of all the sadhus. They would make her go first because they had such regard for her. So she led a life of total spontaneity, just led by the divine will. And like I say, without giving lectures, without writing books, just kind of being places, by her very presence was her message. And she would speak to people, she would answer questions, but she never gave formal talks. But she had an influence on literally millions of people. Mahatma Gandhi came to her. All the freedom fighters came to her. Later, Nehru, the first prime minister of India, came to her, and his daughter came to her. But she influenced everyone when I traveled with Ma, I saw so many amazing people that came to her. And it ranged literally from just the beggars in the street to great, exalted, spiritual, and even intellectual and political figures. So she had a very wide influence just by her presence, which was recognized in India.
As I was reading your book, in certain aspects of her life reminded me of another Indian saint, Ramakrishna. And there were three things that stood out for me as far as a kind of a parallel with him, is that she was married and he was married. And a lot of times, you know, these great spiritual teachers don't enter into marriage. And the second thing was they were both prone to enter into these divine ecstatic states for oftentimes quite lengthy periods of time. And the third similarity, which you already touched on, was neither she nor Ramakrishna really had much formal education, but yet they had this sort of spontaneous knowledge about spiritual realities and teachings. Maybe you could comment on those three things. I don't know how much you know about Ramakrishna, but as far as her life goes.
Ramakrishna, I've been to his where he lived many times. That's a very astute observation. There are a lot of similarities, and there are actually some kind of mystical links between the two. I don't think we have time to go into that now, but I've studied that also. And what's really important is the similarity you didn't mention is that they were both extremely universal. Ma was the essence of universality. She always said she experienced, and she always said everything comes from unity and goes back into unity. So what I want to mention here is Sri Ramakrishna lived in a time in the late 19th century in India where things were very sectarian. And each group was fighting against the other, and they didn't accept the other religions. And there was a lot of sectarianism, which is not really the main viewpoint of Sanatana Dharma called Hinduism. Really, it's supposed to be very universal, but it slipped into sectarianism. And for the first time, Sri Ramakrishna recognized all world religions. And if you remember, you read his life, he practiced spontaneously. He practiced all the different sadhanas within Hinduism. And then he even practiced Islam. He even practiced Christianity, had a vision of Jesus Christ merging into him. So he brought a breadth of vision to India and to the world that recognized all paths and all religions as leading to the same goal. And that was hugely important. Now, I think now the universality, which is more common in our society today, stems from him breaking ground like that. And what Ma has in common is Ma spontaneously, I'll use that word a lot because that was her life, did even more. Like I say, she never practiced spiritual discipline for illumination. She was in that state from birth. But she went through 6 years of what we call her sadhana lila. Lila means just a play. This is done for the divine joy. She received this divine command that she was just supposed to sit and watch these things happen in her body. So for 6 years, she went through this in total silence. She withdrew into this small area and was in silence for 6 years. Two things happened in that period. As she was just watching, because she was way back in her consciousness in this perfect state of unity with God and just watching all this happen in her body and mind, two things happened. First, all the stages that a regular sadhaka, that's a person who's a spiritual practitioner, all the stages that he or she will go through unfolded spontaneously within her over a long period of time. So she could observe it and see exactly what was supposed to happen. I say she didn't have a guru. Even at the time when in that unfolding, there would be a necessity for a guru. It was called Julan Purnima, a full moon in August 1920-something. All the scriptural preparation for initiation happened spontaneously in her body and around her. And then the guru tattva, that's the principle of the guru, the principle of God coming to teach a person how to come to him. That's what the guru is. The guru principle came out from outside, inside of her as a being, and gave her initiation and was absorbed back into her. So she, one sense, she did have a guru, but it was the sat-guru of the world. So that was one thing. So all these things unfolded. The other thing is, after that, every possible known sadhana, that's every possible known spiritual practice from every tradition and every religion, spontaneously played within her body. Yogas that take yogis lifetimes to perfect, she would, as she was watching, study, it would start playing in her body, you know, different kind of techniques and mantras and sounds, and it would come to full realization, and then it would stop, and then another one would start. So she literally became an embodiment of all spiritual paths. So then later when people came to her for instructions and for guidance, she could minutely instruct them. No matter what their path is, it was already played within her own being. so she could give instructions on how to do this, how to do that. Mm-hmm. So that brought universality to even a new level. So that's what I find one of the main things in common with Sri Ramakrishna, among many things, is they brought a broader vision of spirituality and religion to the world.
And she never, far as I understand it, she never encouraged her followers to see her as their guru, but I can imagine it was difficult for them not to. Can you speak to how she felt about that?
Yes. She would always say, she rarely used the pronoun I. She would usually refer to herself as this body in Hindi or Bengali, Ye Sharir, this body says. So she would often say, this body is no one's guru. And I pondered that a lot because also Ramana Maharshi said the same thing. And many people had him as a guru. Sri Ramakrishna actually acted as a guru. Actually, Ramana Maharshi answered the question for me. He said, for a jnani is someone who's in perfect knowledge, like he was, like Ma was. For a jnani, it's impossible for him to think of himself as a guru and to have someone else as a disciple, because they see only unity. They see the one Atma. They're in such a state, exalted state of unitive consciousness, they can't possibly think they're going to instruct someone. But we found both with Ma and with Ramana and these other people, if people came with a true longing and put themselves in the position of a disciple, that is, with humility, with eagerness to learn, and with a steadfast resolve to practice what was taught to them, she would definitely act as a guru. And later on, and so it was interesting. So people always wanted to be initiated into her lineage. So from early times, her husband, who she named Bholanath, her husband is a very interesting relationship. He was her first disciple. At the same time, she was a very obedient wife, and she checked things with him and lived like a Hindu wife. But he was her first disciple and then started following her. He was as his guru. So it was a complicated relationship. But he, under Ma's direction, did intense sadhana for many years and attained a very high state of spirituality. So in the early years, people who wanted to come and receive diksha as initiation into her lineage, he would give the initiation, and she would just sit there. And people felt that came through her, through him. So she would kind of guide him, and he would give it. He passed away in 1936, and then her mother, Mokshadas Sundari Devi, who was a saint from birth. We have a wonderful story of her life. She took sannyas, that's the monastic vows. It became Swami Muktananda Giri because she just wanted to stay with Ma at all times. So she traveled with Ma, and her one joy was just to have her, to sit and have her eyes resting on Ma. Ma said about her that such a saint is only born once in centuries. She was a wonderful, perfect, realized yogi and saint, but she kept it all very much inside, very humble. So then Ma had her give the initiation. So she had hundreds of disciples, and she would know what mantra to give. And Ma would sit there and be with it, so it all come. It felt like it all came through her. So she gave initiation. There's so many beautiful stories. We called her Didi Ma, which means grandmother. And there's so many beautiful stories about her. She was such an amazing being. She passed away in 1970. And then from about 70 or 71 on, Ma herself came up again spontaneously with a very interesting kind of tantric way of giving initiation herself. So I was fortunate. I came in 73 and received initiation directly from Ma, from Ma's own hands. Swami Bhaskaranandi, he was there, translating and doing things she said, but she did it all herself. So she came up the last few years of her life, she gave initiation herself to a pretty large amount of number of people who came.
If you just joined us, you're listening to a conversation with Acharya Mangalananda. He's a follower of the great Indian saint Anandamayi Ma, and he's also author of the book A Goddess Among Us, which is a book about Anandamayi Ma. And you're listening to A Better World at 103.7 WPVM in Asheville, North Carolina. Okay, that's Bring Us, O Lord God by William Harris. The artist is Voces 8 from their album After Silence. And today we are talking to Acharya Mangal Ananda, who is a follower of the Indian saint Anandamayi Ma. Was Anandamayi Ma, in terms of her teachings, was she a Vedanta, Advaita Vedanta type of a teacher?
It's a very good question. Ma couldn't be put into any boxes. She instructed everybody according to their own need and their own level of evolution and understanding and need. So she didn't have kind of a one way for everyone. But over the years, especially the 12 years I was living in India at her ashram, we made an intense study of her teachings and all the things we have written down that come from letters she's answered and from satsang she's given, things to recording. We have a pretty good volume of her words. In fact, some recent books have come out with even more. But we studied them. We put them into different categories so we could tell what was Ma saying. And I can make a generalization that she spoke from the highest level of Vedantic vision, where she didn't acknowledge duality at all. She said, everything is God. Everything is a manifestation of the divine. At every moment, the divine is with us. She spoke from this very high viewpoint, which she was experiencing at all times. But she mostly recommended, as most saints in India do, she mostly recommended the path of devotion, of bhakti yoga. And her main thing she recommended as a tool was the mantra, was the divine name. She would always say, take the name of God. And in India, this is the most traditional, and virtually every saint will say this, that it's the safest, most powerful and direct path to just do japa. That's a repetition of a divine name. It can be Ram or Krishna or Shiva or Durga or Jesus or Allah, like the Sufis, La ilaha illallah. There's many, many traditional mantras or sound formulas. And this is basically what Ma recommended. She, but she would also tell people to follow Vedanta if that was their way. She instructed according to their need. But generally, she talked about devotion and repeating the name of God.
If somebody wanted to follow a path that would lead them to self-realization, was it through the bhakti path?
That's generally what she recommended, but if people had different inclinations and temperaments, she would recommend something that would fit their temperament and fit their needs. Generally, it was devotional.
So let me ask you about yourself. Tell me about your background and what was happening in your life at the time you found out about Anandamayi Ma.
Well, I was kind of a child of the hip generation in the 60s and 70s, you know. When I was young, I got involved in the hip movement and drugs and everything. I owe my salvation to that wonderful Swami Satchidananda, direct disciple of Shivananda, who started the integral yoga, which is still very much an active yoga studio in America. He's now founded Yogaville, which is a big, huge community in Virginia. I was recently invited there to speak. I stumbled into one of his lectures on a college campus, and it just inspired me so much to take up yoga and the spiritual life that I corrected my life and got a new sets of friends and stopped taking drugs and cleaned up my act, started following him. And then it was interesting. I was in one of his centers one time at a class, and an American Swami who was a disciple of Anandamayi Ma came. He had just come from India from being with her. And he had a little 8mm film, this is before video cameras, 8mm roll of film that he took of Ma. And he was showing this, he was projecting it onto the wall. And it was showing Ma walking around. I had no idea who she was. I wasn't even particularly interested. I came there for a class. But I was watching Ma, and she was fascinating to see. She had a grace of movement and presence that was stunning. If you're interested, I can tell you more about what it was like to be with her. But I was watching it, and suddenly there was one scene where she came out of a building and she was going to get into a car, but she stopped and she leaned over the car door and looked into the camera. Her face filled the whole camera, whole screen. And she looked at me. I mean, the room was full of people. I felt she looked right at me, and she looked and looked and stared and kind of leaned forward more and looked right into my eyes. Then she kind of sent this power and light from her eyes. It just like zapped me. I was just like drunk. The wow. And then later I saw this. I kept in touch with this Swami. Later I moved into his ashram. I later saw the same roll of film and I asked, is this in any way edited? It was the exact same roll of film. So I was waiting for that great scene to come. So here comes the scene. Oh, but here it comes. She walks out the door, gets into the car and drives off. That wasn't even in. And this is a very typical Anandamayi Ma miracle. Ma would play with reality. She could have multiple realities going on at the same time. I had some experience with that also, but she would do things only the person who was intended to receive it saw it or heard it. But anyway, so I kept in contact with the Swami and eventually moved into his ashram and I wanted to go find Ma. And I called Swami Sachidananda on the phone. And I said, you know, I feel you've been my guru. You've helped me so much, but I had this experience and explained it to him. And he was very humble. He said, I was a rung on the ladder. Take your foot off this rung and go to the next rung. You should go to Ma. So I lived in that man's ashram for a while. It was a very, very strict ashram. And then went to India in 73 just to find Ma. And we found Ma. I followed her around asking for initiation. In fact, from the first day, I had a private with her and I said, I've come to put myself under your guidance. Please give me what I need for my spiritual life. And she was very pleased. And she said, well, the time is right. And then after some time, we were in her Vrindavan ashram in central India, northern India. And she sent a message to my room saying, come tomorrow at the temple, bring these items, you'll have your initiation. And I realized it was my physical birthday. I went when I was 19. It was my 20th birthday. So on my actual birthday, she gave me the real birth, the spiritual birth initiation.
What was it like for you when you first met her in person?
That's an interesting story. I like telling it because it brings me back to that moment. In fact, I've been to the place where many times in her ashram where I went there, and I'll sit there and I'll try to remember it. You know, I'd read about her before coming, and I thought, what would it be like to see her? And so we arrived. She was in Vrindavan because she traveled constantly. You know, she was never spent more than just a few days or at most a few weeks in one place. So it was hard to track her down. We found her in Vrindavan, and we went and we got there in the morning, and I was with several other people. And they told her that we'd come. She was in her room. They said she's been in her room in samadhi all day, this spiritual kind of trance. And so we went to her room. There was an outer room, kind of a waiting room. So we went and sat there on the floor, and there was a little raised platform thing with a blanket on it. And then Ma came out and just sat in front of us. I don't think she even said anything until much, much later. Most of the whole first meeting, she didn't even speak. But she looked at each one of us in the eyes for a long time. To me, it was always a supernatural experience to be with Ma. I can't even describe it. I found when she walked into the room, I tried to always keep my eyes on her. And I found when my eyes just rested on her form, my own mind and being would wake up in a way I didn't know even existed. I would suddenly feel all these areas in my being that I didn't know existed, literally just by having the sight of her. That's the real darshan. So I sat and looked at her. And when I look back on those times, it was so profound. I didn't know how to think of it at the time. I've reasoned through it more. She was so humble. She came out, she was dressed in white, long black hair, but there was almost an emptiness to her presence. There was just no ego. There was just consciousness, but it gave the impression of almost emptiness. Like totally simplistic, totally humble, with no, just sitting there. But simultaneously, she was the unquestioned queen of the universe. There was just this majesty to her being. You know, we're used to great men and women. You know, they have a presence, kind of, but it's an ego, you know, a great being with energy. There was none of that. It was just emptiness, but at the same time, a presence that was unmistakably just divine and awesome. So, see, finally, my turn came, and she just sat very, very humbly and just looked into my eyes. So I looked into her eyes, and she looked past everything. She looked past the body, the mind, the experiences, the lives. She looked right at my divine soul, and she saw it. And so in her vision, suddenly I realized I was a soul also for the first time. You know what I mean? If someone stares at your hand for a long time, suddenly you become very self-conscious and you're aware of your hand, you know? Mm-hmm. She stared at my immortal soul. And I was sitting there realizing, no one has ever seen me before. I'm way back here and they only see this mask way in front of me. Ma was the first person who's seen me. And it was always a very satisfying experience to be seen by Ma, because she really saw you. She saw your real being.
So you spent 1973 and 74 there. Did after those years, were you ever in her presence again?
Unfortunately not, in that because I went back to America and I went back to this Swami's ashram who I was living with before I came, and kind of committed myself to be living in this ashram. I gave whatever possessions I had and lived as a member of this ashram. And he would go back usually once a year and he would take some people with him. But then I spent so much time with Mar, I was kind of at the bottom of the list of when I was going to be taken. And I didn't have my own funds to go back myself. So I was just hoping I would get back. And then after a few years, she left her body. So I was very sad about that. But at the same time, I felt I had gotten what I needed. Mm-hmm. And I felt then and I feel now that she lives within me totally all the time. So that connection was made. So it would have been wonderful to have seen her again. I would love to go see her now. But on one level, what needed to happen happened and is happening.
So what sort of activities are you involved in now in regards to Anandamayi Ma?
Well, I host I'm on the board of the Anandamayi Ma Ashram and Temple, which is at the moment in Massachusetts. I'm on the board of directors there. And I host a monthly Mathri Satsang, that's what we call it, on Zoom. We had a group here of people who would meet, you know, devotees of Ma who would meet, and I would lead that before COVID. And COVID was a blessing because we started doing this on Zoom, and now people from all over the world come. So we have kind of an online worldwide community of Ma devotees, and we meet once a month. I host that. And I do the ashram I was living in gave me the title Acharya. That just means you're supposed to pass on Ma's teachings with your experience of having tried to live them. And they assigned me to do two things, do that and also keep spreading the names of God, singing and meditating on the names of God. This kirtan is the call and response chanting of mantras, of names of God, in a beautiful way. So it's not just monomelodic. It's done according to Indian ragas and things. So it's very melodic. And I was trained in that, and I've kind of been doing that my whole life. So I have kirtans. I have a really good kirtan band. I have some great musicians with me. And so we sing all over this area here, where I'm in the San Francisco area, whenever we can. You know, we have events, and we get people to sing these names with us, and people love that. And I teach. I am invited to speak at different places. I'm invited every year to Shivananda Ashram in the Bahamas, which is kind of a good gig. They fly a whole band there, and we give some concerts, and I give several classes on Ma's teachings. And I'm invited in different places. Like I say, I just got invited to Yogaville in Virginia. I go regularly to the Shivananda Yoga Farm to be a teacher and a singer there also. So wherever people invite me, people like you invite me for interviews. So Ma has given me this job, and I just am there when she arranges things as she wills, and I try to just do my part. And of course, the main thing is I do my daily practice that she gave me. That's the real service of Ma. Somebody asked Ma, how can we serve the Guru? And Ma said, by doing what the Guru told you. Mm-hmm. So I try to do that also.
Well, speaking of practice, I wanted to ask you about a teaching that is similar to a teaching from Ramana Maharshi. Ramana Maharshi taught this method called self-inquiry. Anandamayi Ma also taught self-inquiry, but she called it, I think, if I'm correct, the art of staying. Can you talk about that part of her teaching and what it involves as a spiritual practice?
Yeah, well, technically in Sanskrit it's called Atma Vichara. Mm-hmm. That means Vichara is a thought or a concept. So it's having the concept of the Atma always in mind. Ramana Maharshi had a very distinct way of meditating, where he would just go into our go into a person's consciousness and just ask, who am I that's experiencing this? And try to find the source of the I. It's a very direct method. Ma would sometimes recommend that. She didn't recommend that to me. So I know what she gave me. And I've just kind of seen from the outside other things she gave other people and things she said. But she would always recommend keeping in mind that we are the eternal spirit. She would say, inquire who am I, to step back from the mind and its thoughts and feel yourself as consciousness. And I incorporate that into my meditation too. I start my meditation with that, but then from there I call out to God in the name, with the mantra I was given. So I'm familiar with Ramana Maharshi's practice, and I've been in his ashram many times. It's pretty much the same thing that he taught. Ma would emphasize that in the same way. And they had a connection also. Ma was connected with all the saints of India. And they all had this, communication.
I mean, part of her teaching, as far as I could tell from your book and what I've read online, is related to the reality or unreality of the world around us. I think that's such a difficult thing for a lot of people to grasp, is that the unreality of this world. And I found that Atmavichara, self-inquiry, kind of helps one to kind of get a better sense of what's real and what's not real. And that was a significant part of her teaching, was it not, about teaching people about what was real and what's not real?
That's a very good question. And it just, the answer that comes to my mind is so massive. I don't know. I'll try to make it very simple. I would say yes and no. Mm-hmm. She did constantly stress that this world is always in movement, and God is the only stable, real thing. She would often say, have you not seen what this world is? The one to be loved is God, and him is everything. Him you must try to find. So she'd always stress that God was the only reality, and the search after God was the only real obligation of any human being. And she never told us to neglect our responsibilities. She said, I never tell anyone to go to a jungle. I tell people to stand up in the position right where they are and change their perspective. She did stress the reality of God, the ephemeral nature of this world and its pleasures and enjoyments and things, and how she'd always say the sense objects are full of poison. So try to concentrate on God. But an important point is the Vedantists, like along the line of Adi Shankaracharya, say that the world is all Maya. The world is unreal. The universe is unreal. What we're seeing is unreal. Only the self is real. So then they negate it all by saying this word, neti, neti, not this, not this. This isn't real. This isn't real. Only the self is real. That's a valid path, but it's the exact opposite of Ma's. Ma gave the path, what we call iti, iti. All this, all this, all this. She said, Maya, this illusion, is not external. It's in our vision. It's the cataract on our spiritual eyes. She said, what you're seeing is the being of God at all times. And see, this is very tantric. Maybe you shouldn't go into that word, because that word is so confused. Tantric is just working with the Divine Mother. This is a very scriptural way of seeing things in the Divine Mother, let's use that word, Divine Mother tradition, that she stressed at all times, everything that comes to us is God, everything that happens to us is God. So she stressed, and we following her teachings in our ashram in India, and in my sadhana here, and in my teachings here, we try to stress that this thing, that we accept everything as God, we don't negate anything. We accept that what we're seeing, what we're experiencing is the divine. And we just have to clear our vision to see it correctly. So it's a very, in one way, it's a very different concept. And it's not unique to Ma, but it's unique to the Divine Mother tradition.
You're listening to A Better World at 103.7 WPVM in Asheville, North Carolina. And we're streaming live at WPVMFM.org. And our guest today is Acharya Mangalananda, and we are talking about the great Indian saint Anandamayi Ma, and we'll return in just a few minutes after this break. ¶¶ Okay, welcome back. That's Brenda McMorrow singing Ananda Mai from the album Igniting the Beauty. And our guest today is Acharya Mangalananda. And we are talking about Ananda Mai Ma, the great Indian saint. There are many spiritual teachers that I've read about over the years that emphasize the value of service as a means to progress on the spiritual path. People like Paramahansa Yogananda, Swami Vivekananda, Sathya Sai Baba. Was this part of Ananda Mai Ma's teaching as well?
Very much so. She said, love manifests as service. If you love God, the way you manifest that is you serve all as God. And service in itself as a spiritual path is called Karma Yoga. Ma would always stress the synthesis of all the yogas. You see, the basic paths of yoga are bhakti yoga, the yoga of devotion, jnana yoga, the yoga of consciousness, like Ramana Maharshi. Karma yoga is the yoga of action. And she would stress that you have to have all three. Now, according to a person's temperament, they'll specialize or concentrate more on one rather than the other. But she would always stress, if you're doing karma yoga, if you're serving, if you don't have a meditation practice where you keep your mind clear and calm and stable as you're serving, it can always turn into egotism, it can turn into anger, you know, it could have a bad turn. If you're only meditating and you're not doing any service, you can both get lazy and very selfish, you know, just self-centered and just go thinking around yourself. So she said, try to integrate the different yogas, but with an emphasis on what your perspective is. Like I integrate all of them, but my specialty is bhakti yoga because that's just my temperament and the way she led me. Mm-hmm. But she and all the saints say that we have to serve. We can call the worldly state of mind or the mind of the human being who's not trying to consciously practice spiritual life is so often very self-centered. Like when we look at a person, we'll think, what can I get from this person? How can they help me? How can they serve me? How can I, profit from them? Can they give me a connection to get a job? Will they marry me? You know, there's all these selfish motivations. And in doing seva means selfless action. It means service without any anticipation of results. When you're doing seva, you're thinking of that person as a divine manifestation and you're serving them without expecting anything and without wanting anything. And you offer the fruits of this service to God. So in that way, karma doesn't bind you. In other words, that way, this action doesn't create more karma. Because when we do action selfishly, we create either bad karma or good karma, but we have to come back to keep reaping those fruits. So when we do service selflessly and offer the fruits to God, that karma is extinguished. We go to God. But Ma did emphasize that, yes.
You talk in the book, A Goddess Among Us, about how she traveled around India for a long time, never staying in one place for very long. I found it interesting because some spiritual teachers stay put, like Ramana Maharshi, he stayed in the same town pretty much his whole life, while others like Ananda Mai Ma were always on the go. Did she ever talk about the purpose of traveling so much? Was it just to kind of make herself available to people that wanted to see her?
Yes. like I could say, Sri Ramakrishna rarely left the place. Swami Sivananda rarely left. It's true. The most common appearance of a saint will be they're pretty much in an ashram doing their thing, and people come to them. Ma, some people would ask Ma many times. They say, Ma, why are you so restless? Why do you wander? And Ma was always so humble and so joyful and very playful. And she would say, oh, I'm just a restless little girl. I just have to wander. But then people would keep pressing her, because like, they wouldn't accept that. And she would say things like, you see me moving. I experience no movement. She said, I'm just walking from one room of my house to the other. Sometimes she would say, I've come to just visit my garden, my flowers in the garden. I'm just visiting my garden, all the different flowers in my garden. But really what it was is she was, if you look at the different instances in Ma's life, she was constantly fulfilling devotees' needs. There's beautiful stories of people who were longing to see Ma, and Ma would just walk in the room, here I am. So she had literally no self-motivation whatsoever. She literally didn't even eat with her own hands. From the times after that sadhana lila I told you about, when devotees started coming for her, she had so little even self-preservation for her body, because she was just in this divine consciousness. So she found that, you know, for us to eat, we have to have at least the knowledge, the desire to keep the body alive. You know, so we try to eat, you know, to appease our hunger or to keep from dying. But Ma had no even self-preservation. She was preservation. She was in the state of perfect oneness and unity. She needed nothing. So she found that she couldn't even raise her hand to her mouth to put the food in, because that would require some kind of desire. And she was totally desireless. So at one point she even said, if you want this body to continue, you'll have to feed it like a child, because it can't take care of itself. So I've seen people who would normally just feed Ma. She would take a few bites of food and turn away. So she ate very little. So she had no self-motivation in, I'm going to go out and help people. I'm going to publicize myself. None of that. She was literally just an open heart, a living open heart. And she could sense the hearts of the devotees and their needs, and she would just come as they needed it. All these wonderful stories of illustration are coming to my mind, but I don't think we have time to go through it all. Just of Ma just appearing somewhere and saying, I'm here, don't cry, you know.
Were the ashrams that were set up in India based on kind of where she spent the most time, or tell me something about her ashrams these days.
The first ashram was in Bengal before she left and started traveling. People were coming to this place called Shaba Gardens. This is where her husband Bolanat was working. It was a big garden of a nahab, of a Muslim ruler. And people were coming just by word of mouth. There's this wonderful Mathji there, and people would just come. And so she started having people do kirtan, and people would ask her advice, and she would give advice. It was all very, again, spontaneous. So eventually some people wanted to start an ashram and say, why don't we have an ashram where people can come and you can be there, and we won't have to have this external difficulties that we're having. And she laughed and she said, there's so many ashrams in India. My ashram is the whole universe. Why do you need another one? But they insisted, as you know, out of love. And so she gave some directions for it. And she would always say, insist. She would always insist. These are not my ashrams. They're your ashrams. You started them. So the first ashram started. Shortly after it started, she left. She would come back occasionally, but she would travel. So she would usually, at first, she just stayed on the banks of rivers and in temples. You know, a few people were traveling with her. And eventually, as more and more devotees came, and kind of a spiritual family was formed, other devotees, this as you said, they wanted a place where Ma could be more comfortable and people could have more access to her. So these different ashrams were started, and she would overlook them, and she would give some recommendations for the inmates who lived there, and then eventually it became more as like when I at the, more toward the end of her life, when I knew her, she was a little more she had a little more of a schedule. They would invite her here and there, develop this so we could kind of know where she would be going. But then other times she would just go off on her own. So the ashram slowly developed again spontaneously with no particular plan. Mm-hmm. And then later they became legally incorporated into the Maisanga, and Ma never became an institution. And I think that's a very good thing in her life. Like so many of these saints, when they leave, they want their teachings passed on, as they should be. And so an institution forms around it, and it gets very wooden, and they have a lot of rules and a lot of strange things happen. Fortunately, that never happened with Ma. Many of the ashrams that were very active when she was alive had just become ghost towns now. There are, I would say, there were 24 ashrams at one point. I would say, I've been to most of them, I would say 6 or 8 of them are still very active.
Is she buried in one of them?
Yes, in Kankal, which is in North India, right south of Haridwar, on the River Ganges, the Ganga. There's a beautiful ashram. That was the last place I saw Ma in person, matter of fact. She left her body in her ashram in Dehradun, which is up in the Himalayan foothills. And it's very interesting. She left her ashram, and all the sadhus heard of it immediately. And the sadhus, the sannyasis, the monks, these very strict people, they had such reverence for Ma, they came and just took over and said, okay, leave it alone, we're doing this. And they carried her in procession on their shoulders, maybe 100 kilometers back to Haridwar, and they themselves performed the rites for what's called the samadhi. That's the shrine where the body is interred. Because usually householders are burned, you know, cremated, and their ashes are spread somewhere. But Ma was in such veneration. They did the scriptural way. They have it's a big marble, I guess you could call it, sarcophagus. And they put ashes and camphor and stuff, and they put her body in, seated in Padmasana, Yogasana, seated upright. And then they seal the top, you know. So her body is there in Kankal, and it's very powerful. And there's now kind of a beautiful marble temple built over it, and some halls and things. And so this that's kind of considered the main ashram now.
Have you been there since she passed, been to that particular ashram?
Many, many times. In fact, I was there a couple of years ago. I try to go back very often. Sometimes I take groups there, and we sit and meditate there. You do feel Ma's presence there. It's very beautiful. And they do deity kind of worships, and they do songs, and they have a school there for boys. Yeah, so it's a very good place, very powerful.
What is God's grace in terms of Anandamayi Ma?
The word in Sanskrit is kripa, and grace is everything. And Ma always stressed this. For anyone to even begin spiritual life, I've seen this in my own life, I've seen it in many people's lives, to even understand what spiritual life is, what to speak of, having a desire to do it, we have to be touched first by the grace of God. And Ma spoke many times. She said, grace is always flowing at all times to everybody. Grace is pouring like a waterfall at all times from God. It's God's nature to pour out grace. Grace is just this stream of mercy, compassion, forgiveness, and it's the stream that wakes us up and draws us back to the being of God, back to our own self. And Ma said, the grace of God is always flowing, but she said, but if you take a vessel and you put it under a waterfall upside down, the inside remains dry. So she said, the reason we have to do sadhana, spiritual practice, is we're learning to turn our vessel right side up so we can catch that nectar of grace. Because she said, grace flows, but we have to be prepared and competent to accept it, to feel it, to work with it. And that's what spiritual practice is, working with grace. But it's nothing we do on our own. Grace completes our sadhana. It's moment to moment, day by day. We live by grace only. And Ma stressed this many times.
That's Acharya Mangalananda, and he's our guest today on A Better World. And we are talking about the great Indian saint Anandamayi Ma. And you're listening to us on A Better World at 103.7 WPVM in Asheville, North Carolina. ரகசிய யோகினியும் நீயே ஆனந்தமை சிதானந்தமை சச்சிதானந்தமை தேவி மூகாம்பிகே ஆதிசக்தியும் அனந்தமும் நீயே பராபராதி ரகசிய யோகினியும். Okay, welcome back. That's Ravi Shankar, and the song is Anandamayi. And our guest today is Acharya Mangalananda. He's a follower of Anandamayi Ma. What do you think is the relevance of her life for today's world?
Another very good question. Like I mentioned earlier, we have these Mathri Sat songs, which is on Zoom now, where we study her different events from her life, just how she lived her life, how she responded to situations, responded to people. We read about how people viewed her and related to her. And then we study her teachings, which are basically what she asks of us to do and what she instructs us to do to find her grace. I always say Ma is so relevant today because she is a perfect receptacle of divine grace. She's a window into universal consciousness and into our own consciousness. These great ones who've come, Ram, Krishna, Jesus Christ, Sri Ramakrishna, they are manifestations of that perfect divine consciousness, which we are. We are that consciousness, but we have it all covered up by mud, you know, by the inner turmoil of our minds. So these wonderful ones have come, and when they've left this world, they've left their name and their form and their teaching as a portal. And Ma is very much, very much in that category, that she came for, 86 years in this world and walked in this world, but she's still a very much a living force. And not only you can study her teachings, which are wise, which are, you know, helpful to spiritual life, but many, she is still herself the message. So she's very approachable. She's very reachable. And it's a skill to learn how to tune into her. That's one of the things we practice in our Matri Satsang. I've traveled the world. The ashram sent me many times traveling, and back every year into Europe and America to give classes and to sing kirtan and things. And I've met so many people who never met Ma physically in the flesh, but who have Ma as a living reality in their life. I know in my own life and so many people, devotees' lives, if we just call on her, she really responds and she guides us. You feel her presence. So she is one, a teacher of wonderful things we can learn from, but secondly, or mainly, she's a source of blessing which we can contact personally by just learning about her, saying her name, thinking of her. We always read at the beginning of Matri Satsang her own words, where she says, "When anyone thinks of this body, when thinks of me," she says, "I immediately see their face in my mind. It's like you shine a torch on their face. I see all your expressions. Whenever you just think about me or meditate on me or sit down to pray to me, I immediately see you." So because she has universal consciousness, she can do this. Anyone in the world, she immediately sees when they think of her. So I think she's very relevant to today.
Did she ever require people that, say, weren't Hindu or Muslim who went to see her, did she ever require that they give up their particular faith in order to follow her or be a devotee of hers?
Another good question. All your questions are quite good and quite relevant. The exact opposite. In fact, emphatically the opposite. Christians would come to her, and she would speak to them in Christian terminology. She would even give the name of Jesus as a mantra to them often. There's a wonderful account of how a Muslim man was once, in this early time in Shabha Gardens, there was a kirtan going on. Kirtan is the Hindu practice of singing the Sanskrit names of God. That was going on, and a Muslim man was standing outside kind of watching. And Ma left the kirtan and walked by him and said, "Come with me." And they went to a shrine of a Sufi saint, and she started doing the perfect namaz. That's the prayer they do five times a day, the Islamic prayer. She started doing perfectly with all the correct pronunciation and Arabic and everything, and making all the bows. And so the two of them did it together. And then the man came back, and he was so immersed in Ma, he came to the Hindu kirtan. So she kind of brought him back and forth. So she never insisted anyone change their religion. In fact, she would usually say a person is born into a religion because of their karma to experience that. And there was no requirement to be a Hindu to follow her at all, at all. She was just the essence of universality. She would say, "Try to study your own religion, learn it better." Many of us did, in a sense, convert to Hinduism. I don't even like that term because I'm still very much a Christian also. I just expanded my vision and my viewpoint beyond the limits of dogmatism. So she would never insist on anyone changing or being a Hindu or not being a Hindu. She said, "Follow the way God leads you." So she, again, her essence of universality.
Are there a couple of takeaways, perhaps, that people that read your book, A Goddess Among Us, that you hope people would take away from reading the book?
I put in there a very short but interesting sketch of her life, because it's so much. The main thing I had trouble I had in writing it was, what do I leave out? Because it's, you know, there was just so much to put in. Kind of the outline of her life, so you can get an idea of how she lived and the miraculous way she lived. And then I put a couple of chapters of the essence of what I think of the essence of her teachings, about how everything is God, about how the name of God will help you. I even put in the end one of her beautiful recommendations for a type of meditation. So I hope people take away from the book Ma's reachable presence and her universality. Also, an important thing is, very few people had her as a guru, as a teacher in herself. They had other gurus, and their gurus would send them to Ma. They would say, you have to go to Ma. She's the universal mother. So whether a person has another teacher or anything, or follows a different path, makes no difference. Ma is the universal mother, the divine mother who shelters us and who and nourishes us and gives us life. So there's no way that you're not having any kind of infidelity to another teacher by coming to Ma. In fact, she would always say, do what your guru tells you. That was her main thing. When someone comes and says, Ma, what do I do? She would say, do what your guru tells you. But they had Ma as that overshadowing mother of all. So I hope people take away her great universality and her great reachability, accessibility.
Are there any resources the people that might be listening want to find out more about her that you can recommend?
Yes, there are very many books. Even on Amazon, which people tend to get everything from these days, there's one called The Essential Anandamayi Ma by someone named Lipsky. It's a Westerner. And it has a nice collection of her teachings and her life and things. Of course, my book is an introduction. It's meant to be a small introduction, A Goddess Among Us. So The Essential Anandamayi Ma, there's, if you can find any books by Bhitika Mukherjee, she's a Bengali lady who grew up with Ma. She's considered the most correct biographer of Ma. There's a beautiful book by my friend Lisa Hallstrom, whose name is Pragya Hallstrom, who hosts our Matu Satsang in the Boston area, called Mother of Bliss. And she didn't meet Ma, but she went with her family to India a few years ago and spent, I think, a year and a half there researching Ma and interviewing so many direct disciples. So the book is full of beautiful interviews with people who live with Ma most of their lives, and people who were just devotees of Ma and were with her. So it's also a very informative book and beautiful to read.
Final question, is anything else you'd like to share?
Well, people are welcome to come to our Matri Satsang. It's the third Sunday of every month at 1 o'clock Pacific, 4 o'clock Eastern. If you look at my website, if you can think of my, remember my name, Mangalananda, if you look at mangalananda.org, there's a link there. It's the same link every month. And you're welcome to come and kind of be a part of our community and tune in and hear about mine. We have an open discussion afterwards so people can talk and share things and ask questions and things like that too. And just read of Ma and learn of her and access her wonderful blessings that comes from her.
Okay, on that note, I want to thank Acharya Mangalananda for coming on the show today and talking to us about Anandamayi Ma. And he's also author of the book, A Goddess Among Us. Thank you so much for coming on the show, and all the best to you.
Thank you for the invitation and for the really uplifting work that you're doing too. May God continue to lead you in that.
You've been listening to A Better World at 103.7 WPVM in Asheville, North Carolina. This is McNair Ezard. Thank you for joining us, and hopefully we'll see you next time on A Better World. And we're going out today with a song called Narayana, and it's by Mangalananda and friends, I should say. And the album is Auspicious Bliss. Narayana, Narayana.